You're listening to Nick Luck Daily. This edition is brought to you by FitzDares, by the Racehorse Owners Association, and by Thoroughbred Racing Commentaries Global Rankings. Good morning, Wednesday the 21st of July. Thanks for listening in once again. It's another blazing day in TW11. Long may they continue. 20 miles down the road at Ascot, I would imagine it's much the same ahead of this weekend's feature race, the King George VI and Queen Elizabeth Stakes. Later in this edition, I'll be talking to William Buick, looking to win another King George, this time on Derby winner Adeyar. I'll also be speaking to Martin Mead, the trainer of Lone Eagle, who was second to Adeyar's stable companion Hurricane Lane in the Irish Derby, and once again is the mount of Frankie Dettori. That's all to look forward to. I will also be following up yesterday's extended edition on the Panorama documentary the night before last, and I'll be discussing the ramifications of that with Jane Mangan. But first today, in a week where restrictions were lifted by the British government, how soon will it be before they are imposed once again? It was announced earlier this week that nightclubs would be subject to COVID health passes from the end of September, beginning of October, amounting, given that most of the adult population will be vaccinated by then, to a vaccination passport. And it's been suggested that sporting events and large gatherings will be asked by the government, if not mandated, to do the same thing. So from the autumn then, is it inevitable that we'll have to have a double vaccination passport to enter a racecourse? And that's the first question I put to the Racecourse Association Chief Executive, David Armstrong.
Well, I think, Nick, as is the case being at several points in the pandemic, is the answer is it's not clear yet. When government first announced the return of spectators and the return of normality for the 19th of July, they also accompanied that with wording about what was called COVID certification, or is now the COVID health pass. This week, we saw the Prime Minister also announce that government will look at making COVID certification mandatory from the 1st of October in certain circumstances. And nightclubs were singled out, but large sports events were also mentioned. Now, what that means is there will now be a phase of the next few weeks where we look at what are the protocols, what events are captured by that, and what actually needs to be done. Now, that work sort of actually kicks off this afternoon with a meeting with DCMS and multiple sports and the SGSA that'll be looking at how that might be done. In the meantime, we at the RCA have been developing the protocols that would be necessary for COVID certification were it to be introduced either on the 1st of October or if we felt it was necessary to bring it in earlier than that. So we're quite far advanced in that work.
So it's entirely possible that we will have to produce a COVID certificate to get into a racecourse. You will have to have been double vaccinated to go racing.
Well, it's a little early to say yet because it's not clear which venues are going to be caught under this definition. There's an article I think I saw on the BBC this morning that mentioned any event over 20,000 people. But typically the idea of using a single sort of measure like spectator numbers or crowd numbers is shied away from in that it's a very crude instrument. It doesn't take account, for example, for racing, the 20,000 people at a large outdoor venue spread across a large race course is a far less risk than 1,000 people in a nightclub. So the use of an absolute limit of number of people is one that most sports have tried to discourage government from using.
So are you pushing back hard against this? Will you push back hard against this?
Yes, we will. Although we've got to be mindful of what the medical advice, government advice tells us to do. If government does mandate that certain checks or protocols are needed from the 1st of October or another date, then we must follow that. But we will be working with government and this multi-sports group to say, is this really necessary? What are the circumstances in which we might need to test? Could we do it as a spot-checking basis, for example, rather than 100% of people? There are lots and lots of options that need to be worked through in the next, I think it's going to be about the next 4 weeks this work's going to be done.
But just to be clear, David, is this evidence of having had a negative PCR test or a negative lateral flow to gain entry, or is this proof that you have been double vaccinated, as is the case with the nightclubs?
Well, if you think about what you've seen so far with the ERP and what's called the ERP3 program test events or pilot events, which included this weekend the Silverstone Grand Prix and the British Open Golf, at those, you need to be able to demonstrate that you've got a green tick on your COVID certification app, the NHS app that captures all of that data. To get a green tick, you've got to have either been double vaccinated for more than 2 weeks, you have to have had a negative LFT test, a negative PCR test, or have demonstrated that you have antibodies by being someone who's tested positive for COVID within the last 6 months. So if you have any one of those things, or more than one, you will have a green tick on your app. On that basis, you're allowed to enter the venue, and that's the way in which all the events in ERP 3 have worked. So that's the basis that's been tested so far. Come 1 October, of course, it should be the case that every adult in the country will have at least been offered the opportunity to have one and a second vaccination. So therefore, the vaccination protection level should be much higher. So government have talked about potentially it only being vaccination on 1 October, but that's not definite yet, and that's part of what's being worked on now.
So it sounds from what you're saying as though 1st of October, you're half expecting vaccination passport.
I think there will be some form of passport. Whether it applies to racing or not, I think still has to be debated.
Well, listening to all that, no doubt, with an arched eyebrow, was Jane Mangan, RTE and Racing TV broadcaster. You need a vaccination passport to get out the front door in Ireland, don't you, Jane?
You know, what's funny is I don't even have one, so I can't leave the front door. I would happily take my vaccination passport to the moon if necessary, but at the moment in the UK, you guys are not in a position to complain because your counterparts over here are essentially chained to the door.
There will be a human rights argument, won't there, about needing a vaccination passport to attend a legally staged event when the country is supposed to be free of restrictions. I would have thought. I mean, there's going to be a wider debate rather than an internal debate about horse racing's place in this.
Look, I'm not against it. I raised the question last week as to why fully vaccinated people couldn't attend the Galway Festival. It didn't even come into the thought process of the Irish government. So if it's something that works in the UK, we can follow your lead again. But at this stage, I would take all advantages that are given to you.
So on a serious point then, just taking the temperature in Ireland, if they said to you, right, you can only attend the Galway Festival if you're proven to be double vaccinated, do you think there'd be a massive take-up of people going and be very happy with that? Or would there be pushback?
Oh, there's always going to be a slight degree of pushback. But to be honest, coming in next month, there is a rule whereby you can only dine indoors if you are fully vaccinated. Is that not dissimilar to if you wanted to go to an event, you have to be fully vaccinated? I think it is. As somebody who isn't fully vaccinated, I won't be able to dine indoors until I get my second jab in August. So there's always going to be a certain degree of pushback. You're never going to please everyone. But the whole point of getting the vaccines and getting them rolled out as quickly as possible was surely that we could resume normality as quickly as possible.
So it seems it's not inevitable, but it's a strong possibility, reading between the lines from what David Armstrong was saying, that sports and racing could be one of those events where there's mandatory double vaccination passport for entry to racecourses from October the 1st. Talking of cheating the system, that was one of the questions that emerged from the Panorama documentary. Now, if you missed yesterday's edition of the podcast, we dealt with that in real depth for a full 35 minutes with a range of experts, and I'd urge you to go back and listen to it all, a full review of Panorama's expose entitled The Dark Side of Horse Racing on BBC One the night before last. Jane, as I say, one of the issues that came out of that was the falsification or replication of microchips to pass horses off as other horses so they could enter the food chain in the Drury and Son slaughterhouse that was featured in the film. And the government, the Irish government, or HRI, Horse Racing Ireland, has referred this to the police.
Absolutely, because it's a serious, and maybe I was naive, that was one of the things that really struck me from the programme, that was possible. And reading Chris Cook's interview today with Stephen Potter, the director and owner of Drury and Sons, he actually is quoted saying that the chip is not a secure identity product, that there is a deep need for a relook at how horses are securely identified. So it obviously is it common practice? Is it how prevalent is this? It raises an awful lot of questions. I remember Tammy's Hill winning the 2014 Fox Hunters. I rode in the race, and I was completely baffled that this was possible. I remember him getting hurt in the Irish Grand National, and he was euthanized then. So when he turned up on the program, or he actually didn't turn up on the program, how was that possible? The Gardaí are going to investigate, but I wonder, outside of this case, is it isolated? And if it isn't, how prevalent is it?
Was there anything else in the documentary that surprised you?
Absolutely. I didn't realise the number of Irish horses being transferred to the UK. To see horses that were non-weight-bearing being travelled to the UK was disturbing. And I know now, in 2021, since the expiry of the tripartite agreement, that they can be a horse transported to the UK without rigorous health checks from the department. But I know there's only one authorised equine abattoir in Ireland, or approved equine abattoir in Ireland, but I didn't realise the number of horses that were going to the UK.
Does that beg the question, then, there should be more approved equine abattoirs in Ireland?
It begs the question, is there a need for another one? Or just answer the question as to why they were going. That's how you find out whether there's a need for a second one. I suppose the whole point is that the one we have in Ireland is properly regulated, and the department have come out and said that they are satisfied with the standard of care in Ireland. So there are a number of questions that have been raised from this Panorama programme that both the BHA and the IHRB and HRI have to address and answer some questions.
And the slightly unsavoury but actual economic truth of it is that, as has been pointed out, it costs money to have a horse euthanised at home or elsewhere, and you will receive money for the horse's value as meat. So if you have enough horses, the swing between the two is going to produce, if you're a dealer that is so minded, a lucrative, if slightly grim, sideline.
Yeah, there was a question raised, should all thoroughbred racehorses be taken out of the food chain? I really believe that if you are a horse owner or a horse lover, that you will sacrifice the couple of hundred quid and give your horse a dignified end, and give him a dignified end at home. So I'm only speaking from my own perspective. Everybody's is different, but that's just my take out from this. If you're worried about a couple of hundred quid, then maybe you shouldn't have a horse in the first place.
I mean, Jane, quite understandably, a lot of eyes have been on the Panorama documentary and the fallout, but there is a rumbling issue in Ireland that really needs to be dealt with, and it's Stephen Mann. Just tell me what's going on here. Just give everybody a little bit of background if they've missed this.
Yeah, so I think every listener will be familiar that Stephen Mann, after a second offence, has been given a 4-year ban, which is under appeal, from training after a number of horses were found to be mistreated at his premises under his care. But subsequently, it seems Stephen Mann has got himself as a job as a travelling head lad for Pat Kelly. And he was at the races. A number of his horses that he used to train himself have now been returned in training under the care of Pat Kelly, including Stormy, who was in competitive action at Tipperary last Sunday. And the IHRB assistant, Miss A. O'Keefe, veterinary assistant, had to report or refer Stephen Mann to the IHRB and to the stewards on the day because of behaviour, because a post-race sample was being taken from Stormy. And he was accused of interfering with the sampling process by insisting that she turn the tumbler used to collect the urine sample upside down to prove that there was nothing in it prior to the sample being taken. And basically his actions were referred to the CEO of the IHRB. Personally, and this is just from my own perspective, I think it is wrong that somebody who is banned for 4 years for such serious allegations can still go racing and work in the industry. That's just my perspective. Everybody has their own take on it. And I think this is something the IHRB need to take more seriously, because if you can get a 4-year ban and still operate within the industry, there is something systemically wrong.
So on to the weekend's racing, the King George VI and Queen Elizabeth Stakes at Ascot. And one of the great things about this year's race is that it sees the reappearance of the Derby winner, Adeyar, who will be ridden by William Buick. He chose to ride Hurricane Lane in the Derby. Subsequent events showed that his judgment wasn't that far wide of the mark, but he was well beaten by a stable companion. He's back on board on Saturday. He's been talking to me about how he's feeling in the lead up to the race.
The King George is a real highlight of the sort of midsummer or the, you know, it's a middle distance championship, and it's the sort of first chance over the distance for the 3-year-olds to take on the older horses. So it's always a fascinating race.
Now, I know you didn't ride Adeyar in the Derby, but he's a horse that you obviously know well. You were behind him on Hurricane Lane, who's subsequently gone on to win two Group 1s. You are well placed to tell me how good you think this group of 3-year-old colts is.
Yeah, I think they're a good bunch. I mean, I thought Adeyar was very impressive at Epsom. You can't take away from what he did that day. I thought he was a very impressive Derby winner. It didn't come as a complete surprise, you know. He's lead up to the race, although he didn't win any of his two trials, he ran well in both of them. And, Hurricane Lane has obviously taken the Derby at Epsom very well, and he come out of it and possibly has improved a little bit from it. I think winning the Irish Derby and the Grand Prix de Paris, you'd have to say he's taken a step forward for sure.
If there was a surprise to everybody at Epsom, it seemed to be that Adeyar had a real turn of foot to add to what we already knew was a strong staying game.
He's just looked like a very good horse at Epsom. Adam gave him a great ride, and he got the split at the perfect time and didn't have to move. He was drawn one and never moved off the rail once. He didn't cover any extra ground, which is obviously a huge advantage, but it's very unusual to get away with that round Epsom.
Do you think he's a horse that needs a drop of rain to be seen at his very best?
Well, not necessarily. Well, like most people, just want good ground. Good ground, no jar in it, and then that's a level playing field for everyone, isn't it? The Derby was obviously very soft on the Friday, and then we started a Saturday on probably a little bit tacky ground. Then by the time the Derby was run, it probably dried out to nearly good ground, you would say. And to be honest, when he ran at Lingfield in the Lingfield Derby trial, you could say the ground was a bit soft for him. Like we saw at Epsom, he's a horse with a kick. So for that to be fully effective, you certainly wouldn't want the ground too slow. But look, if we get good ground, I think everyone will be very happy.
Now, you've got this race by the short and curlies in some respects, because you rode Ordaria, who pushed love all the way in the Prince of Wales at Ascot. You rode Wonderful Tonight to be very impressive in the Hardwick, albeit in the mud. So you've got a pretty good line on what it's going to take to win this race. Can you talk to me about it from that perspective?
Yeah, I mean, Love, she commands huge respect. She's a fantastic filly. And has a near faultless record. She was very impressive in all her starts last year. And she got the job done in the Prince of Wales. I think there were two good fillies, both Love and Ordaria. And on the day, Love just prevailed. I'm sure she would come on for that. And I'm sure she will probably be better up to a mile and a half. Wonderful Tonight, she's Grand Dependent. But like you said, she was very impressive in the Hardwick. She was very impressive when she won the Fillies and Mares on Champions Day last year. And if she were to get her ground conditions, of course she's a danger. She's a genuine Group 1 filly who stays well and, again, has all the required abilities to be very competitive.
William, we've talked a little bit this week, and I've spoken to you as well about it, the lack of vaccinations amongst your weighing room colleagues at the moment for one reason or another, and I know practicality is part of it. Jerry Hill's tried very hard to make sure there are facilities for jockeys to be able to get vaccinated, and you were saying to me you had your second one yesterday.
I had my second one yesterday, so that's all up and running. And in between that, I also had an antibody test, which fortunately showed that I have the required antibodies to be safe or to have the same effect as a fully vaccinated person. But obviously,
due to all the different legislations and, you know, rules and laws and things changing all the time. You know, I had my final Pfizer shot last night, and obviously it was all on the advice of Dr. Jerry Hill, who's been a great help, and he's been very good.
And I know he's trying really hard to make it as straightforward as possible for all the jockeys who are dashing hither and everywhere to get a jab. But would you urge people to sort of take a bit of personal responsibility as well?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, obviously, you know, you can't force anyone to do anything. But, you know, personally, from a personal point of view, you know, if you want to travel, if you want to get on with, if you want to get back to normality, we all have to get vaccinated. And certainly it's made very convenient for us, because a lot of the vaccination stations are at race courses. So the chances are that, you know, you could even be riding at the meeting where they have a station. So, look, especially for jockeys who, you know, we do, you know, share a changing room together, although the changing rooms are, you know, COVID safe with partitions up and you have your own little space. But of course, if everyone's vaccinated, it just becomes that much more safer. So from jockey's point of view, I think, because the majority of us, you know, the job entails travelling a lot as well. So like you said, it's a no-brainer.
Right, Jane, William Buick there, freshly vaccinated, double vaccinated, and heading towards the King George at Ascot on Saturday. Hell of a race, this. We have a Derby winner in the race, and that doesn't happen very often these days.
No, I had to do a little bit of digging here. The last horse to complete the Epsom King George double was Galileo 20 years ago. Can I ask you, how many horses in the interim have attempted the double?
How many Derby winners have even run in the race in the last 20 years? I would say it's no more than 5.
Yeah, you're very close. Only 3 horses since 2001, since
wow.
Galileo.
Yeah.
Can you name the 3?
Well, Workforce was definitely one, and he blew out behind his stablemate Harbinger in 2010. I remember that quite clearly. Kriskin? Did Kriskin run in the King George?
He sure did in 2003.
Oh, and it'll be an Aiden.
More recently.
It'll be one of the Aidens, but I can't actually remember which one it was that ran in it.
Anthony van Dijk in 2019.
Oh, yeah, finished up the track.
That's an A-, well done.
I'll take that every day of the week, especially, at 43, I'll take that every day of the week. 23, I'd have been disappointed with that.
It's a surprisingly low number. I would have thought that more Epsom Derby winners would have attempted the King George, especially with the weighted irons. But there they are. We have them this weekend.
We do. So do you think he's got the star quality to win a King George?
I really do. Now, he surprised me at Epsom. I've made no secret of that. But the manner of his win was dominant. And I'd like to think that he can step forward from that and take on his elders, get the weight allowance and make the most use of it.
And where do you stand on Love? Good or potentially great?
What she beat last year was questionable, but the manner was not. She was always authoritative. I thought her win over 10 furlongs in the Prince of Wales last time looked like she needed every yard of the trip back up to a mile and a half is going to suit her. It was her first run since August of last year. She's entitled to improve significantly for that. She deserves to be favoured. Top of the ground, everybody has suggested that she needs really good ground. She's going to get this, and she's going to get her opportunity to prove her worth.
Except what you said about entitled to improve. I was a little bit underwhelmed by the Prince of Wales, is only given that she was gifted the race, really, by Ryan Moore being allowed to set his own fractions under very little pace pressure. And she had that inside rail on the round course on the day when the ground was quickest and nothing was coming from off the back. I do think she's going to have to step forward again.
Yeah, that's a fair argument, but I thought on her first run since August, she was entitled to improve from that. She looked like 10 furlongs was her... You know, she needed every yard of that trip, I think up to a mile and a half. We'll see her to improve again, but she's going to have to. This is the first time where she's beating, she's going to take on real top-class opposition, and I hope she can prove her worth. She's got a big reputation. This is her opportunity to prove it.
What about the other three-year-old in the race, Lone Eagle, who ran such a fine race to be second in the Irish Derby? His trainer, Martin Mead, joins me now. Martin, what confidence can you give me going into the weekend?
Well, I was thrilled with his run in Macau, I have to say. And everything was right about the race. Everything he did in the race was right. The only problem was the result, I suppose. He's come out of it very well. He's a horse that's very, very straightforward, and he's just flourishing, I think. And obviously, you know, on Saturday is a big task, but you know, I'm sort of confident that you know, he'll produce a really good showing there.
I don't want to torture you too much, but you've been in the game a long time. You've seen most things. Tell me about that last furlong on the Curra and the roller coaster of emotions that you and everybody must have felt.
Well, I think the problem with the way that the race sort of panned out, of course, you know, we were left in front with no sort of pacemaker, and I thought that he'd go on for a little bit longer. And then I suppose Frankie had no option but to go. And certainly the two furlong, I'm thinking, well, you know, not ideal to sort of go at this stage. But at the one furlong, I think, good Lord, I think there is a chance we're going to win this. And of course, you know, when you look behind and I can see the blue colours sort of looming on us, and I thought, surely he's never going to get there. But of course, you know, our horse, you know, we didn't have anything to aim at. He's, you know, if anything, I wouldn't say idling in front by any means, but, you know, there's no time when something gets on your heels like that to actually, you know, to get momentum again, to actually have a fight with the other horse. So I'm afraid it was a beautifully timed run as far as Yuri was concerned, but, you know, it was just one of those unfortunate things. I'd love to see, you know, what would happen if we ran the race again. And at that two furlong marker, you know, if the winner had been upside us then, I wonder what would have happened. That would have been the really interesting one. But of course, we'll never know.
Frankie Dettori obviously has ridden many great horses. What did he say to you about the horse's raw quality and ability?
Well, he was just very, very enthusiastic about the horse. Obviously, very upset about the result. But, you know, he said he just kept on giving and giving and giving, and he couldn't have asked for any more. He said it was an absolute delight to ride. Hence the reason that he's really keen to ride him on Saturday.
Have you seen a difference in the horse since the Curra? Has he moved forward mentally?
No, he's very, very laid back at home, so it's really difficult to, you know, form any judgment either way on him. I mean, he just does exactly what's required of him, no more. You know, he's just in a very good place in terms of his, you know, general demeanour. You know, he's a horse that's always, you know, eaten well. He's not a problem. But as you know, all these good horses are so, you know, simple and straightforward. So, you know, he's just where he's always been. And I only think that these, you know, this sort of racing does seem to bring him on, does seem to bring the best out of him. And, you know, he's risen to everything that we asked him to. I mean, there's only one race that, you know, I scratched my head about, and that was the sort of Sandown race. And I just think that was a funny sort of race. But I mean, that's the only foot that he's put wrong. If indeed he did put a foot wrong, I suppose, you know, he came fourth behind some good horses. So I don't suppose you can be critical about that. But it's, you know, everything else, he's progressed. And we don't know just how good he is going to be. You know, maybe the Curra was a pinnacle, maybe not. And obviously we'll know a bit more after Saturday.
And I know when you really started getting involved in the sport at a much higher level, you were doing it because you wanted to do it at the very, very, you know, elite level. How important is a horse like him right now? How important is this race to establish the sort of Mead enterprise at Manton and to push you where you want to get to?
Well, horses like him are absolutely critical. You know, I mean, without that, I mean, it's all very well. You can have all the ambitions in the world, but if you haven't got the raw materials to work with, I mean, you are, you know, completely done for. And as you know, again, they're very, very difficult to find. And I think that, you know, we have to go through quite a few, you know, to find those, you know, half a dozen horses that we can really work on and hope we can get them into that sort of elite bunch. And, you know, we're very lucky to have him. I mean, he's, you know, done us proud. You always need to have that one talking horse every season and then two or three others sort of, you know, hopefully sort of coming along behind. But he's very important.
And how does that sort of radiate to the whole yard? I mean, you get up in the morning and you go out. If there's a horse like him and you've got the King George to look forward to on Saturday, do you notice a certain elevation in everybody's spirits?
Oh, there's a huge buzz in the yard, you know, when you've got horses running at this thing, because there's a huge amount sort of, you know, riding on the whole thing. You know, it's fine, everybody gets excited about winning a handicap, and winning any race is difficult enough today. But I think in terms of yard morale and that type of thing, you know, we've had a tough time, you know, recently, and to have a really good, you know, Group 1 winner would be a great fill up for everybody. You know, everybody puts in so much hard work, and yeah, and it's quite emotional when you're sort of living with these things. As you say, every morning you get up, every morning, you know, you're hoping, touching every bit of wood, that nothing's going to go wrong. And when you can eventually get to the race course, and if you can win at this level, it's mighty exciting. And of course, you then look at the next step. You know, where do we go from there? You know, if he was to be able to make up a really, really good showing at Ascot, you know, the sky's the limit for him, really.
So Lone Eagle, the obvious other three-year-old, and that run in the Irish Derby is looking all the better subsequently, isn't it?
Well, it's looking like it's standing up, because Wordsworth was again held by Hurricane Lane in the Grand Prix de Paris, and Lone Eagle looked a winner everywhere up the straight in the Curragh bar the line. Frankie was obviously very clever on the front end that day, sat next to the pace and dictated his own fractions, but he's run a good wood, proven it wasn't a fluke, and I'm interested to see how he brings the Irish Derby form, and then Adair brings the Epsom Derby form in against their older horses. This is an intriguing King George in contrast to the one we had last year.
Just give you notice that the Go Racing in Yorkshire Summer Festival continues today. But Jane has a tip for us. Where are you going, Jane?
I'm going to Naas. I'm going to the 5:20 at Naas, the Yeomanstown Stud Stakes. Dark Angel has been a flag bearer for Yeomanstown this year, and anybody who watches Queen of the South would be familiar with the name Teresa Mendoza, and I'm tipping her in the 5:20 at Naas today.
Jane, thank you. Thank you very much for listening. We will see you again tomorrow. That was Wednesday, July the 21st. Bye-bye. Enjoy the sunshine. You've been listening to Nick Luck Daily, brought to you in association with FitzDares, the Racehorse Owners Association, and Thoroughbred Racing Commentary.